Hello, welcome back to another edition of the Rural Rugby Podcast. Christy Doran in the chair, joined as ever by Matty Tamua. Matt, you're having a little cheeky beer this late evening on Monday when we're recording, is that right?
Well, technically not a beer. It's a strong zero, so I'm trying to immerse myself in the Japanese culture. I'm just learning more and more sushi, strong zero, whiskey. So, yeah, I just feel like it's, market research.
One of the great things about being in Japan, and I've got to cover rugby a couple of times there and at the Olympics, is the vending machines. They're just there. They're here, there, and everywhere, and you can go in a couple of bucks. There you go. You get your Asahi, your Sapporo.
Yeah, they're so cheap. They're very accessible. And, mate, the kombinis are just unbelievable. It's one thing I'll definitely miss. But, it's good. Some positives, that's for sure. But I've just been on the road for a few hours. So just trying to relax, decompress, and get some clear thoughts about the Super Rugby weekend that we had, which was and Super Round, wasn't it?
It was a belter, wasn't it? So we'll talk all about Super Round and be joined by Lucan Salakai-Loto. How a cracking game was a big part of the reason behind the Melbourne Rebels come from behind victory over the Western Force. And we'll look ahead to next week's games. Well, Matt, you're right. Huge Super Round. I'm not sure if Super Round will ever return to Melbourne, but the action on the field, phenomenal. The Waratahs, a huge upset. That was probably the big kind of upset, the big moment of the weekend.
Yeah, headlined. And look, if there's a telltale sign, I think I saw a Brumbies fan cheering a Waratahs tries, which back in my day, that would have been a heinous crime. But if the Brumbies fans are cheering on the Tars, exactly. So if Brumbies fans are cheering on the Tars, then they must be doing something right. But no, it was awesome. It was great to see. And I thought, everyone's talking about Tane Edmund, and fair enough, I thought he was brilliant.
Yeah, let's dig a little bit deeper there. It was probably a performance that not many people saw coming, because Darren Coleman under a hell of a lot of pressure. I was one of, I think, two Aussie journos that spoke to Rob Penny on the Thursday, who said that he felt sorry for the position that Darren Coleman was in with the Waratahs coach in his third season, really coaching for his future, and a decision by the New South Wales Rugby Board expected by the end of March around whether or not he's going to get an extension. Look, they denied the bookies. They were paying $8. I think it went as high as $8.50, and they come away with a 37-24 victory. How did that occur? Was it the Waratahs playing extremely well, the Crusaders not quite being there, or a bit of both?
Boring answers. I think it was a little bit of both, but primarily the Waratahs. You just saw they were super direct. They were super aggressive in their attack. You saw the backs cleaning out. You saw the forwards like dominating that contact zone. And that, for me, you saw it early. It just kind of showed their intent, and you just knew that they were really taking on the Crusaders, and they weren't affected by the aura of the Crusaders. And that being said, I think the Crusaders really struggled in the halves. Like two young guys who are going to be good, I'm very sure. But, by the end of the game, I think they completely swapped the halves. Probably a sign that there's going to be a few teething issues after, losing someone like Richie Mwanga, who we know has been unbelievable for the Crusaders.
Yeah, so you're right. A brand new halves pairing played together at school, but by the end of it was Mitch Drummond and David Havilia, who I think had jumped into 10. And you compare that to the Waratahs. I think Jake Gordon played the entire 80 minutes. Spare thought for Teddy Wilson, who was probably chomping in the bit to get out there. But Tane Edmund had probably his best game since he led the Tars to a huge victory against the Crusaders at Leichhardt Oval in 2022. So what in particular did you like about Tane's game? Because he missed a tackle early on, but then from that second minute, he was pretty much faultless for the rest of the evening.
Yeah, recovering from adversity and responding to it is a huge part. Like, you're never going to get a 100% game. No one ever gets that. And I guess that's just a nice indication of where his mindset was at. But for me, as much as I want to say he was amazing, which he was, he was a part of a greater system. And we've often ironically said this about the Crusaders: whoever slots in, can just play well because, the systems are really great. But he played his role, he played it smart, he played it strong, he was physical, and he had a little bit of that grit, which I think, sometimes with fly halves, we like to see the offload, the kick, all that. And he just had a little bit of that kind of rugby league grit, which we like every now and then. So It was great, and I think he's probably proud he didn't cry in the post match. The boys I know were giving him a bit of a stick, but it was awesome to see.
He did all the little things really well, and I mean, he struck the ball great from the tee. He made a couple of try-saving efforts there to deny Severis. He then denied Scott Barrett towards the end in the final few minutes by hitting the ball out. But a lovely moment on the stroke of halftime where he squares up from a line out, manages to break the line, send Harry Wilson away. That's probably what a fly half's dream almost is. It would be way too premature to start saying that this guy's a Wallabies kind of contender, but he's this sort of age profile that's not a bad thing. He's a guy that's been playing for Super Rugby now for a few years, played Shoot Shield Rugby, and he's just got a little bit of that organisational ability where long kicks really well from kickoffs. Those sorts of things would have caught Joe Schmidt's eye, I imagine.
Yeah, the highlights that you spoke about were, when once again, not traditional things we associate with fly halves in Australia. Yet, and if you go to, you look at someone like an Owen Farrell, he's not a guy who's an offload step guy. He's got grit. He can, you know, he will fight. And for me, seeing someone in a jersey like that is great. You know, try saving tackles from a fly half. Once again, something that you don't really, you know, you're not expected of. But he's doing that, and then he's kicking his goals. So. Yeah, it's great signs. I think that's very exciting. He needs to do his primary job. He needs to kick his goals. He needs to direct the team around, which he's doing. So probably is a little bit early to be talking about Wallabies and whatnot, but a flashy redhead gets us excited, so why not?
It's interesting when you think about when you were playing Super Rugby and probably before the end of the 2019 World Cup, you had yourself and Christian Leilifano, there was Quade Cooper, there was Bernard Foley, at times there was Kirtley Beale. There was guys of a similar sort of age group that played against one another, and I imagine that the competitiveness would have really spurned you both, or all of you, on to greater things. Yeah. You look at the age group of the guys at the moment: Edmund, 23, Donaldson, 24, Carter Gordon, 23, Tom Lyoner, 20, Max Bury in his early 20s, Harry McLaughlin-Phillips, I think he's 19. Can you see, if Australian Rugby can hang on to them all, those sorts of guys taking 2, 3, 4, 5 years, Noah Lolasio, another guy there, 23, 24, those sorts of guys managing to be not just the Wallabies 10 for the next World Cup, but for two World Cup editions, which is, sees a Wallabies player go from playing 50 caps to 100 caps and hopefully being a real star in Australian rugby.
Yeah, definitely. A couple of years ago, you know, Noah was starting for the Wallabies, and I was lucky enough to be alongside Carter at the Rebels, and I know how much that irritated him. You know, he was a zero cap Wallaby at the time, Carter. Noah was starting and Carter was in and out of the Rebels team, but I know that motivated him. I know that irked him a lot. And I think of me as well as the same when I had guys like Quaid and Kirtley ahead of me. And look, that competition's great. I mean, you know it in business, you know, or whatever competition is good. And I think we've genuinely got that. Whilst we are talking premature about Tane, you know, and Wallabies, we got to remember that he was chosen ahead of Donaldson at 10 for the Waratahs for a long time, and Donaldson is actually in our incumbent. So it's not too far a stretch to be saying those things, and to be having this conversation is a really good thing, particularly around such an important position, because there are options there, and that's a great thing to have.
Yeah. So it's easy to forget as well. Tane Edmund goes to Japan with the Australia A side in 2022. Donaldson ends up getting taken on the spring tour, and that surprised the Tars officials. They thought that Edmund at the time was ahead of Ben Donaldson, and that probably also was a contributing factor in last year, Ben Donaldson at times in the 10 jersey. And I know that Tane was plagued by his back injury, but I think both he and Donaldson will probably shine and prosper by the fact that they're now, it seems like, the 10s at their franchises. Like, Tane Edmund doesn't have Ben Donaldson, who people were thinking is the Wallabies incumbent. Why is he not playing 10 for the Waratahs? So, yeah, it'll be really interesting to see how these 10s develop. He wasn't the only one, though, on Saturday night that stood out. Joey Walton was a really good foil at 12. Max Jorgensen, similarly, at 15. But they don't get in those positions. And I think we saw that with the Brumbies on Sunday afternoon when the Brumbies halves and back line had terrible ball, and that's because of a forward back rolling up their sleeves. Like, what did you think of the Tars forward pack and allowing that platform for those guys to play behind?
Yeah, they were great, and it's often things that we don't like. We've just been speaking the last 10 minutes about the fly halves, so it's yeah. I think it's we need to speak about the pack and particularly their attacking ruck. They're attacking ruck and cleaning strong, fast, past the ball, you know, denying the opposition the chance to kind of get line speed was awesome. And you saw it from a few of the backs as well. And that to me is showing that they've got a nice system in place, that it's not always the number on your back. I think one thing that really stood out in Super Round was teams' ability to convert once they're in the 22. And we spoke about this with Laurie Fisher, and you saw it with good teams on the weekend, that once you get inside the 22, it's all systems go. It's direct, it's strong, it's hard, it's aggressive. And the Waratahs showed that really early. And it was cool. It was really good to see, because you can see some genuine coaching. You can see some culture. You can kind of see that it shines in those bits. So, that was really positive for me.
A couple of guys I'm going to give a shout out to. Mahe Vaiolanu, I thought he was excellent. The hooker, pressure on the ball, as you're making mention of. Charlie Gamble had one of his better games. He's an out-and-out seven. Hugh Sinclair, you know, that charge down, that's effort. He's probably not the most physically biggest specimen, but, you know, when you're down a man and you do that, I think that had come shortly after Harry Johnson-Holmes had been given 10 minutes. A huge play by Hugh Sinclair. But Ned Hannigan as well, off the bench, a really nice shift, managed to, you know, exert himself physically and put some pressure on the breakdown as well. He's a much improved player, Ned Hannigan, over the last few years.
He is. And look, we got Lucan on coming on a little bit later, but he's another guy who has just benefited from going overseas or just time to develop. You know, like, he hasn't just, you know, there was a time when Ned came on and then he got criticized quite a lot, and then it's quite easy to forget about him, kind of pick up the next kind of shiny toy. But he's someone who's really developed, and I thought that was really good. You spoke about Mahe Vaiolanu. I think there was, you know, he was crucial in denying the Crusaders a try on a chase back 70 minutes into the game. Like, that stuff is that they're really good signs early in the season to have your hooker who's played in a few, you know, he's been around a little bit, but to be chasing back and showing that amount of care and that amount of grit late in the game is awesome. So, look, and to be fair, we didn't see it in the first round. It was something that we're probably a little bit concerned about with the Waratahs, but I don't know about you, it's exciting to see them performing like that.
You need a strong Waratahs or a strong Reds, because that's where, you know, the bulk of rugby fans and the nurseries are on the east coast of Australia. It's undeniable that. So, really good, encouraging signs ahead of the Tars taking on the Highlanders on Friday night, and probably get a prediction on that later on.
We've got to see if DC's off the beers yet, but that'll be an interesting game.
That was one. Do you like that when you're a player, hearing those sorts of remarks when you coach?
Absolutely. It's like, because we're all thinking it, aren't we? Like, we're human. And look, media is a really interesting one, because you come up and you're taught you've got to kind of appease to the sponsors. You can't say anything too controversial or whatnot, and so you do it. And then you get someone like DC saying he's going to have 10 or 15 schooners. I was just watching the UFC, or I was actually just watching Tyson Fury, and his media pump up just being like, I think it's nice seeing the human element to people. Podcasts have been really good for that because you get that long chat. But I think we've been a little bit too conservative with how we approach those things. And sure, we're not encouraging binge drinking or anything like that, but I'd like to think that most people kind of understand that.
Yeah, I think it's a really valid point. It's totally refreshing. And in Australia, particularly when you're crying out for more headlines, those sorts of one-liners actually go a long, long way because it just made everyone laugh, didn't it? It certainly showed the human side of it all. We know that Darren Coleman enjoys a beer, but fair enough. I'm glad that I'm sure he did have a couple. But, he wakes up the next morning and I know that he starts the next day looking at tape around the Highlanders. So, yeah, awesome moment. Good luck to Darren Coleman and this weekend's task, and hopefully a big rollout in Sydney for their first home game of the year. It actually had a lot of optimism going into Sunday. The Waratahs taking down the Crusaders. We thought, could there be another victory over Trans-Tasman opposition on Sunday? Well, we got a bit of a reality check, didn't we, on the first game with the Brumbies and the Chiefs?
Yeah, we sure did. I was bragging to all my Kiwi mates. We're one in a row here, Kiwi Aussies against Kiwi teams. But, yeah, look, Brumbies got a hiding by a very, very strong, smart Chiefs team. They were incredible, and you could see what they were trying to do to the Brumbies, and that was they showed how to beat the Brumbies, not – really limit the stoppages, really try and play at pace. Not always perfect, but just moving the pack around, not allowing the Brumbies to kind of find their feet. And it was two things. I think the Chiefs were amazing. The Brumbies looked a little bit rattled too, to be fair.
Yeah, and you imagine, I think Darcy Swain's not too far away. Hopefully Caden Neville's okay because he copped a big knock towards the end that resulted, and I think it was an upgraded red. That looked nasty though, and hopefully those two guys come back because they need a bit more physicality, I think, in that tight five. Clearly no Alan Alatoa just yet either, but it was surprising knowing that they lost last year's semi-final to the Chiefs. And I imagine that you take those scars and you want to atone for a loss like that the next time you come up against them. But they were flat from the outset. And probably no Laurie Fisher there, no Dan Palmer there. Maybe a couple of teething issues around expectations. Like Laurie Fisher's the master of going, this is acceptable, this isn't. Mm. We've got to make sure that we turn up. Were you surprised how flat the Brumbies were?
Yeah, I was. In the contact zone, they were clearly getting beaten to the punch, but there was a couple of phases early in the game around the middle part of the field where passes were going a little bit behind, a little bit jerky, and it just looked a little bit off. And look, that happens. The Brumbies, as you say, you maybe got a little bit influenced by the week before of a big win. But I think the Chiefs really came there to prove a point. They looked like they would have beaten any team by a few, to be fair. Look, the Brumbies can control it. It's well within their capabilities to respond the next week. But I think, Brumbies have always been proud about how consistent they are in their performances. And I think if you look at week one and you look at week two, there's a significant difference there. And I'm sure Stephen Larkham's not happy with that.
Yeah, so it was 46-12 and a couple of tries to Corey Toole. Wow, he has the ability to find the try line. He was probably the one positive coming from that game. And if you're Joe Schmidt, you're going X Factor, John Manenti, I'm not sure if you're going to be taking this boy to Paris because he's playing pretty well.
Oh, he's exciting, isn't he? He scored a bucket load of tries in a short amount of... And he had no right to as well. Yeah, he had no right to. He's creating something out of nothing. Noah's thrown a great little pass over the top there around the middle of the field, and he's just through effort, through sheer pace, the guys who he's stood up. It was great. And I think one thing for me that's quite exciting about with Toole is his defensive game is pretty strong as well. He's not missing, often with these kind of really fast wingers who are great on attack, they have a huge deficit in their defense, but he's someone who's kind of, showing that he's up to that physical bit, because that'll be the test going into test matches is that the physicality jumps up a lot. You're not playing against wingers who are scared or short or whatever. You've got guys, so that's exciting for me. I thought that was a good thing for him. So look, we spoke about him before. We'll say we were pretty good at predicting things, but he's been an exciting machine for sure.
Yeah, you're not wrong, and I think the fact that he plays has played and dominated Sevens, really. I think he was Sevens Rookie Player of the Year a couple of years ago. That exposes you. It just heightens everything. It's 7-on-7. If you can't defend, you're going to get targeted in defense. So he's holding up extremely well. The Hurricanes and the Reds, blimey, that was a good game to round it out. And heartbreak for Les Kiss's side after looking like they were going to hold on, but a couple of tries. Yeah. Cam Royguard, he's a seriously talented halfback. What impressed you about the Reds on the weekend? They didn't get the chocolates, but they came very, very close.
They did. Look, physically for me, I think with teams like the Hurricanes, the Chiefs, the Blues, we often admire the step, the flick, the offload, the counter attack ability. But how they set that is their aggressive, their physical nature, their attacking breakdown. It's really what separates Kiwi teams from a lot of other teams. And for me, the Reds were unreal. Physically, they met the Hurricanes. And we saw the week before against the Force, how much the Hurricanes dominated them. It's nice to see an Aussie team. I'm sure you felt the same way. It was nice to see an Aussie team stand up and actually give it to them physically.
Yeah. And the other thing that stood out to me was the first half, probably the second 20 minutes of the first half, the Reds had a fair bit of possession and they just kept attacking the short side. They were just playing either side of the ruck, and thought that was showed a bit of maturity from Tate McDermott around knowing the game situation, the awareness. But the forwards just rolling up their sleeves, from Zane Nongor to Matty Fesler. Alex Hodgman was really good until he was forced off with injury. But Harry Wilson scoring again. Fraser McWright was everywhere. So it's really encouraging signs from Les Kiss's Reds team. And it's just a tiny missed opportunity at the end, though, because they take on the Chiefs and the Rebels, and it's games can quickly build and get away from you. And a match like that was there for the taking, that's the thing that lingers in the frustrating moment for fans, but also Les Kiss, because if the Reds don't win the next couple, they don't win one in the next couple, you forget about how they played against the Hurricanes. All you start seeing is the losses that add up.
Yeah, it's such a delicate balance because, Les Kiss, obviously, new coach, new environment. You speak about learning from your experiences or get confidence in the new structure. So there'll be a balance of, taking the positives out of, we stuck it to these guys and we should have done really well. But at the same time, we lost. But so it'll be really interesting to see how he approaches that. It'll be really interesting to see how the Reds attack the next game. I think, to be fair, they've got some leaders in their team now. You saw the 7, 8, 9. The balance between those guys, between McWright, Wilson and Tate is really cool. They're making plays, and I think they've got enough experience now. It's they're experienced men where they should be able to, on a Monday, all right, lads, let's go, next game. We've been there, we've done that. And so, look, I'd be expecting more out of them. I think it's really exciting from an Aussie rugby fan to see them sticking it to a Kiwi team physically, because I think that's just where we've been bullied in the past.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you at all. Look, we're going to talk about the Rebels and Force a little bit more with Luke and Salakai Loto, but just before he joins us, it was an unbelievable comeback. And those that didn't kind of watch it and maybe living under a rock, the Force were up, I think it was 34-19 at one point in time. And then three straight tries in 5 minutes. Josh Kemeny, Carter Gordon intercept, Filippo Downguna scores from a box kick and ends up getting the ball. Unbelievable turn of events when it looked like it was going to be a long evening for the Rebels at home.
It did. Look, I was watching the game and I was, as a former player for the Rebels, it was something I was getting quite nervous about, because the Force just looked in control. Their attack was, it kind of, the Rebels looked very similar to last week, making a lot of the same mistakes over and over. But big moments, big players stood up, big players stood up. Carter Gordon just out of nowhere, getting an intercept or whatever. Luke Khan taking some big carries. The scrum was a huge positive. We spoke about, we thought Taniela would start and he did, and and it was good to see. It was really good to see. We know it's been a tough time for them, and for the big players to stand up in big moments. Yeah, huge turning point. And you know, we might speak about it later on. And conversely, I thought the Force, you know, taking off your captain, your vice, and your two vice captains within 5 minutes in a moment where, you know, they were losing momentum. I think that's something that, you know, Simon Cron will probably look at later, that maybe it was a missed opportunity because they really lacked leadership in that last 20 minutes.
Yeah, it's a really good point. Okay, let's find out a little bit more about that now. Well, it's a very warm welcome to Mr. Lukan Salakailoto. It's quite late in Australian Eastern Standard Time, Monday night. You can blame Mr. Matt Tamua. He's been rather busy this afternoon playing a bit of tour guide in Japan. But Lukan, thanks for jumping on. How are you?
Yeah, all good. Thanks for having me. Cheers, Pop. Jumping on the podcast for a bit of family avoidance, is it?
thanks, Matt, for turning up late. Just dictating terms as always. I just... Keeping you wondering, mate, but no, I appreciate it.
Well, Lukan, it's been a good weekend for the Melbourne Rebels. You've had a great come from behind victory against the Western Force. Can you just bring me into the game situation just for a little while? Because at the 50-minute mark, things probably weren't quite going your way. It's a hell of a response from not just Carter Gordon, but the key leaders. How did you turn around on Friday night?
Yeah, obviously it was a slow start for us. The Force came out firing, as we expected, and they were a tough opponent on Friday. I think the biggest thing for us was just believing in our systems and trusting the process was a big message that we were driving throughout the week. And I thought guys like you said, Carter Gordon, Kells, Sam Telica off the pine, crucial for us and led really well. So we're happy with the result, and we're quite happy with the way that we did it. As last year, we probably didn't finish off games too well, which was a theme. So it's good to sort of come back in that last 30 and get a result.
We might break it down a little bit more in a moment, the actual game situation. But Lukan, can you bring us into the game, into the sheds straight after? I imagine there would have been a hell of a lot of relief. There would have been a bit of excitement, a couple of beers, maybe a bit of music. And that's something that you dabble in yourself as well.
Yeah, obviously. A bit different to the week before versus the Brumbies, the vibes in the change rooms. I think a bit of relief. You know, there was quite a lot of expectation and outside noise for our group heading into the season. So to get a result off the back of a hard loss against the Brumbies was something that we sort of needed and was probably good for our group. You look at the structure of our group and the guys that we possess, you know, we're building, and I think a result for us is something that we needed to just give us that confidence and just, you know that we're tracking in the right direction.
Yeah, Khan, that the trust in the systems and what you're doing, I guess, comes from results. How important is that momentum? Obviously, a lot going on, and we'll touch on it a little bit later off the field to kind of get a result and kind of, you know, give everyone, you know, a bit of a pick you up a little bit in a way. How important is that momentum into the season?
Oh, it's massive. Results give you confidence in what you're trying to do and trying to implement. And that's exactly what it gave us, was confidence and belief to continue on the, I guess, the path that we're sort of set ourselves and the things that we sort of want to achieve this year. So amongst that, you know, there's a lot of adversity at the club and the players and coaches are facing, both personal and, you know, from a job point of view. So in terms of the group, it was good, but also for the club and the fans, it's nice to get a result. Whilst we know it's only one win and it's, you know, it's nothing too big, you know, it's quite nice to just, you know, see the fans post-game have a smile on their face and people that have been through a bit of hardship these last couple of months, see them sort of happy and you know, full of beans to sort of just keep backing us to do what we're doing.
Is it almost the elephant in the room, or do you guys talk about it? And as a leader, you've come back, you've got a huge amount of experience now under your belt, Lukan. Do you talk about these things, or does it get left unspoken a bit?
I think before the season, you know, it was a bit of a distraction heading into the season. You know, obviously the uncertainty of things and not getting too much clarity around it doesn't help. So it was quite tough back then, but now that the season's started, you can definitely say that the the focus has shifted towards performing and controlling what we can do. And we understand that the best thing we can do in a situation like this is just continue to work hard and get results, because at the end of the day, that's all we can do.
How's obviously I was looking through the squad. There's probably not too many guys now that were there when the Western Force, you know, a similar situation happened, and then to now. But one guy who was there was Kevin Foote, head coach. You know, leaders in these times really, you know, people look up to. How has he been? He was obviously in that, and he moved down to Melbourne at the time, so he probably understands what guys are experiencing. How's he been through this? And yeah, how have you looked up to him?
Yeah, footy's been awesome for us. You know, it's quite unfortunate that he's going through this, you know, a second time. But we're sort of glad that we can lean on him and his expertise around how to go through something like this. You know, footy's someone who's got such a massive grip on the group, and he understands the vibe and how guys are feeling and what they need in certain times. And I believe he's just been on the money in terms of managing us, you know, helping boys, whether that be individually or collectively as a group. He steadied the ship, as well as guys like Sam Talakai, Batsi Liotta, you know, our real leaders in the group. You know, we've got such a young group, you know, as well as guys that are quite experienced. So to have those guys also help footy, as well as some of our other coaches, Jeff Parling, Brad Harris and Tim Sampson, you know, those guys have been around the block. So it's good to have a good mix of guys to help out footy there and sort of, you know, just looking after each other.
You've almost actually got a spare thought for Ryan Lawrence. He was at the Force, I think, and then he went to Austin and in the Major League Rugby, and that no longer existed. That side, he comes to the Rebels, and he's done some good things here in Melbourne. So he could perhaps be the unluckiest player in
he's,
world
he's
rugby.
He's got the six pack to deal with it, though, hasn't he? He's all right.
What do you think, Luke Hart? Ryan Lawrence, is he the most ripped bloke in Super Rugby, or at the very least at the Rebels?
Oh, by far. I've never seen anything like it. Yeah, the good thing is he's quite humble about it. But yeah, it's ridiculous, eh? Like, if only Pup looked like that, then he probably would have got a few more games under his belt.
I probably would have played a bit longer, but unfortunately I like the strong zeros too much.
What's it like, though, after spending a stint in England, coming back to Australia, Super Rugby? Has it been what you expected? Obviously, it's been very tumultuous, what's going on at the Rebels itself. But are you glad you came home? And do you actually even know what your future might hold?
Yeah, I'm stoked to be home. You know, it's good now that I've got a family. It's sort of good to be home and have that support network for us. So that definitely helps, you know, to be part of such a unreal group at the Rebels and the roster that we have and the coaching staff that we also have is something that excites me. And I've enjoyed every single second of it since day one, since I've joined, but also just excited to sort of be back with different outlooks on things and different perspectives. Stuff that I learned and picked up overseas was so good for me, and I benefited from the short time that I did spend over there. So I feel like I'm coming back and, you know, just looking at things from a different lens and probably appreciating my time in Australia a lot more than I did the first time around.
Khan, I'm interested to know how fatherhood and you know, time in England under, you know, spending time with Courtney Laws, Dan Bigger, these kind of players, and just having that experience, how's that affected your, like, outlook on the game? Like, one thing I did notice on the weekend was when the Rebels were down in that last 30, the leaders really stood up, and I said, I think I messaged you after the game, like, you yourself, you really stood up. You could see that. I think maybe in years gone past, you might have been someone who was a bit more emotional and reactive, but you seemed like someone that the team was looking up to. Like that seemed like a clear, you know, difference from your time in the past. I just want to know how has been becoming a father, experience, time, how has that all impacted that?
Yeah, obviously kids change your life, as you know. One thing that I've sort of taken from it that's been massive for me is it just slows you down. In the past, when I was younger, I was quite reactive and I would get quite emotional around a lot of things, not just on the field. So yeah, I think that's taught me a lot to just be patient and sort of feel what I'm feeling and sort of working towards the best outcome, whether that be off the field, on the field, and also being overseas and just surrounding myself and just watching guys like courts and bigs was such an eye-opener, seeing how they do things, how they go about their business, the little one percenters, and you know how they look at the game and break it down. It was something that I took out massively from them. I think as well, like, when I was at the Reds before I left, I was probably one of the older dudes, myself, Nella. You know, whilst we were still quite young in our careers, we didn't have the guys surrounding us to sort of guide us still and sort of learn off. So, you know, I'm only 27, so I headed over to the UK when I was 26. So I was still eager to learn and just be a sponge to guys that had been around the block a few times. And I think none more than Courtney Laws and Dan Bigger, they're, you know, world-class players and even better blokes. So, yeah, I think it was just so beneficial for me, and it's made me a better person, and, you know, I feel like it's improved my game a lot.
Well, I'm interested in both your thoughts on this, but is there, when you're a player and you're out there and it's a year on year, you're growing as a player, but is there moments in time when you see things that change in your life that affect you on the footy field? And is it conversations, or is it a little thing around your training habits that just lead to a direct correlation and improved performance?
Yeah, for me personally, I think one thing that going to England I probably learned a lot from was there's many ways to solve an equation, or there's many ways to win a game, there's many ways to actually have a successful team. I think when you're younger, you're trying to look for that perfect way, and then you may find a way that works, and you think that's the way. But when you go to England, you've got a lot of challenges. You've got seasons in terms of, you know, hot, cold, you know, snow, wet, whatever. Then you've got three different competitions. You've got Six Nations where you lose half your team who go to play for England or whatnot. And you've just got to be quite, your problem solving's got to adjust. And I think that was something that I took away a lot from England, that there are many ways to kind of skin that cat, and it's not necessarily about just like, oh, this is how we did it in 2014 or 13, it was really good, so we must apply that here. You've actually got to have a bit of problem solving skills, so it's probably something that I learned over time.
What did you think, Lucan, that kind of experience overseas, was there something in particular that stood out, or a memorable conversation?
I think I spoke about it earlier to you when I first returned. There was a conversation I had with Courts, just around not wasting your time and sort of, you know, making the most of every opportunity and making the days count, was a big one. I didn't realise that before going over to the UK that he was going to be someone that I, you know, really wanted to base my game around and try and you know, pick apart and learn off. So to go over there and actually, you know, have those interactions, have those conversations around him, and just really learn and just try and break it down was something that was so beneficial for me. And it's all about perspective. Like Pop said, you know, going over, I only knew one way. I had only known what I had known for the 9 years I was at the Reds. So going over with an open mind and just being open to new ways and finding out that there are different ways of doing things was so good for myself. And like I said, coming back here for the second time in Australia, I definitely feel like it's matured me as a player and as a person, and I'm able to probably be the leader that I can be for our team. So I really enjoyed it, and you know, just playing with guys from different parts of the world and other world-class players, you know, it's just fun. You enjoy your rugby, and it's something that, you know, I'm glad that I got to do.
Obviously a positive of coming back to Melbourne is that you're no longer in the Midlands of England. How's Melbourne life been? I know you love your music. Have you been able to get out some vinyl stores, or kind of check out the arts and cultural scene there, or is it dad life?
Yeah, obviously it's a tough grind in the Midlands. You know what it's like, Pop. I think Northampton's a bit more better than Leicester. So, but yeah, massive change. Good to be home. You know, one thing is that my family definitely enjoys it better here in Melbourne. And you know, I'd only come to Melbourne when we'd play the Rebels, and the only thing you'd do was stay at the Crown Plaza and then duck off to the Crown Casino post-game.
Go to the casino, yeah, exactly. Yeah, Macca's afterwards, I think.
Yeah, what's that?
Yeah, oh, yeah, no. It depends if you win or not. If you win, you might go to Steakhouse. If you lose, straight to Macca's on the way home.
But, yeah, around exploring. It's been funny. Obviously, parenthood and fatherhood takes up a lot of your time, but there's just so much to do in Melbourne, and we feel like there's never a day where there's nothing on. So I'm still getting around. I actually walked past the vinyl store that you took me to a couple of years ago, where you said you walked home with a
on my shoulder. Player.
yeah, on your shoulder. So
after a Christmas party, sober.
Yeah, sober. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, very sober.
What's it like when you're overseas and you're playing? Is it as good as experience as you think it might be, or do you actually miss playing in Australia a little bit?
Yeah, I think you always, you know, watching back here and watching Super Rugby for keen eye and seeing who's doing well and you know the teams and how they're going. But one thing that I made sure that I did before I left was that I was going to fully commit to however long I was going to be in the UK. At the time, it was 3 years, and obviously things changed. But when I did get over to the UK, I was fortunate enough to be over there by myself for about a month or two. So to just fully throw myself into the environment and really commit to what they're doing over there and just get a grasp for how they do things and what they're about was something that was important to me. So I could be the best version of myself to the team and really have an impact. So I think if you fully commit and you know just enjoy it for what it is, then yeah, it's definitely going to be an experience that it's made to be. And I think form is a obvious result of that. And so you see the likes of Will Skelton and guys like that, just to name, you know, really kill it over there. It's because of that exactly.
What about last year's World Cup? So you missed out and going to it itself. You guys were World Cup teammates in 2019. Do you miss those moments, and does it make the itch? Do you want to scratch it even more by making sure you pull on that gold jersey again, or you're part of the next big event?
Yeah, well, I think if you're playing in Australia, you're kidding yourself if you aren't thinking that way. Yeah, it was unfortunate to miss out last year, but you know that's something that's out of mind, out of sight for myself. I don't really pay anything to it. You know, I was quite lucky to enjoy the tournament 2019 with Pup. So that was something that was awesome, and just having that experience definitely makes you want to, you know, hopefully be a part of another one in the future.
Yeah, I'm sure you will, Khan. You know, with you lot more experience now. And I remember from 2019, once we did get knocked out, a silver lining for me was no more of that Wim Hof training that we're doing. We were submerging ourselves in this. There's an ice bath and there's an ice bath. So that's one thing I definitely don't miss. But, mate, I'm sure seeing on the weekend, seeing how the guys look up to you, seeing the player that you're developing into and growing into, I think you'll be very surprised if you don't get a few more opportunities in that gold jersey.
Has there been any interaction with Joe Schmidt, or is it, you know, there's a Wales series not too far away, obviously a rugby championship. It's a really big international kind of season. You can't look that far yet, but those sorts of little moments, you and Josh Canham look like a really exciting second row combination. Tell us a little bit more about Josh as well.
Yeah, he's good, eh? He's something that he's someone that I've said to him, you know, that he's a wallaby in waiting, and I think he's possesses all the skills and attributes to be a great wallaby. So he's someone that I'm enjoying playing with. I think the locking partners that I've played with in the past haven't been as quite as skilled as him. Or as athletic, I've always sort of probably partnered up with someone a bit more opposite to myself. So, you know, it's fun to just train with him day in, day out and just see the things that he can do. And, you know, I think, you know, hopefully we can just keep building on our partnership and it can be something that can really drive our pack towards, you know, being successful and not being soft, I guess.
Just lastly, from my perspective anyway, Moana Pacifica this weekend, it's a really big matchup. It's one of those ones where you get a good win and you want to build on that momentum and go back-to-back and take that confidence back before, you know, I think it's taking on the Reds soon after that as well. So what's kind of been the early messages since Friday night's victory against the Force?
Early messages probably... I'd say it's just continuing to just work on what we do and just worrying about ourselves. We understand the threats that they pose, and anytime you play New Zealand against anyone, it's going to be a tough match. And we understand that, you know, Moana is just growing from strength to strength every year. And, you know, they've got a lot more experienced guys coming in now and playing for them. So, and they're also coming off a good win against the Drua. So I think for us, it's just fronting up physically up front. And just really polishing the stuff that we've been doing well, and then working on stuff that we haven't probably been doing as good as would have liked to do. So obviously it's going to be a physical encounter come Friday over in Hamilton, and you know I think you're just going to see you know a team that's just willing to just keep on building and keep on improving. And a result for us this weekend will be massive. So hopefully we can get the job done.
Khan, thanks so much for joining, very late over there. We appreciate it. And obviously a tough time with the Rebels off field, and we know that in these times leadership's super important. So just want to wish you guys all the best, yourself and the leaders in the team. There'll be a lot of people looking up towards you. So yeah, mate, go well as a former player of the club. Wishing you the best, mate. So yeah, thanks a lot again.
Cheers, bro. Cheers, guys. Thank you.
Always good to speak to Luca and Salakai Loto, and he's a bloke that I think we're going to find out a lot more of what he's made of in the coming years, because he seems like a matured man and he's playing some good rugby.
He is. And yeah, we mentioned it when we spoke into it. Like, you could just see the Rebels guys look up to Luca. He's got that imposing figure. He's a tall bloke, but he really led from the front. I think that's really good to see, and seeing a guy develop as he has. I was lucky enough to play with him when he was at the Reds there, and he was often your kind of emotional player that you maybe had to kind of keep a lid on at times and hope he wouldn't give a silly penalty away or whatever. But he's really developed into a good leader, and something that we need in Australian rugby.
And a good tourist.
He is. I don't know how many stories I want to share just here, but no, he's good. He's a lot of fun. I'm glad he kind of brought his PG language, because he can get a little bit colourful at times. But he's a good man.
I think he was whispering at night with the kids probably not being too far away. But he's the sort of kind of guy that it's great that Australian rugby's got him back, because I think he's got a huge amount of potential from an international point of view. Can play both in the second row, six. He featured a lot out under Michael Checker, but it's those sorts of guys that are 26, 27, 28. Australian rugby's just got to keep a hold of, right?
Yeah, we do. It's something that I've noticed a lot. Just the dynamic of Australian rugby, we often lose these guys who are, say Lucan, who had played a couple of Wallaby games, or someone like a Lockie McCaffrey or a Scott Fardy back in the day, who were kind of close there or thereabouts, and then, they get a bigger money offer somewhere else, and they leave, and we lose a lot of that experience. We lose a lot of that, like, the old head, and so then we bring in these young guys from school, from academy systems, who don't have someone to kind of look up to and establish a culture that we're proud of, or establish something that Australian rugby is about. And for me, getting Lucan back and having him speaking to a Josh Canham, having him speaking to a lot of these younger guys, and understanding, this is someone who's been there and done that, I think is really important. And we've seen, another guy, an example of it is Josh Kemeny's, obviously, often. I'm sure you feel the same way I do, in saying that it's a loss to Australian rugby in many ways.
Yeah, well, he's only played, I think, two test matches, and they were both last year. So you start to go, like, this is a player that is starting to play their best rugby, and then you just lose them. It's almost like you set them up, and then with the eligibility status as it is, and it looks like it's going to remain and perhaps even tighten, I think Joe Schmidt's not going to be picking from overseas very much. There might be one or two exceptions. I can't see him going nearly as far as what Eddie Jones did last year. With the Lions coming up in 25 and a home World Cup in 27, they're going to want to tighten those screws up, so that encourages people that if you're thinking of going overseas, you won't get picked. You've got to stay on shore. I found it really fascinating there. Lucan said that at the Reds, he was one of the oldest there, and he was 26, 27. Like, that goes to show how much Australian rugby really does need to keep on to these senior leaders or senior figures in the game. And it's great that guys like Alex Hodgman and Jeffrey Tumanga-Allen are now providing some of that experience at the Reds. Mm. And you spoke about that combo between Fraser McWright, Harry Wilson, Tate McDermott. Like, how influential do you think that kind of mentorship is? And are there any other ways of maybe preventing, or is it about developing such a strong culture that even if you get paid an extra 100 or 200K overseas, you want to stay because you love Australian rugby so much?
It's really hard. Look, it's really, really hard. And unfortunately, I think it probably trickles down from the financial incentives to go overseas. I think in Australia, we're quite impatient, both with our coaches, with our players. We kind of churn through them quickly. You know, oh, he wasn't good up to it, he's out. And then, you know, we sign the next younger guy. And for me, having guys in the environment who have been there for a long time, they might not be your star players, but they are the glue that keeps the team together. I know when I came back to Australian rugby, a guy like Bill Meeks, you know, was whispered every now and then to be in the Wallabies, maybe, maybe not, whatever. But he was such a glue in the team. He would pick guys up. He would, you know, he would develop that younger talent coming through. And I think it's very, very important. How we solve that, I'm not sure, because it's very hard to tell a guy like a Lachie McCaffrey, a Bill Meeks, a Scott Fardy, can you hang around for a couple hundred less? You're probably not going to play in the Wallabies, but we'd like you to bring up this other guy who's going to take your position. Like it's a little bit hard. Whereas I know for me, when I went over to Leicester Tigers, for instance, you had guys there who were one club men. They're there for 20 years. A Ben Youngs, a Dan Coles, a Tom Youngs. They're there the whole time. And whilst you'd like to say they're passionate about their club, financially they could stay there. They're paid well enough to stay at their club. So I don't know what the solution is. All I know is that we need it. We need these older heads in there to help bring through the younger guys, because you know, whilst the younger guys have got lots of talent, as we've seen, there are things that kind of get you through the season in terms of responding and whatnot.
You've gone overseas a couple of times, and you went straight after but pretty soon after the 2015 World Cup to the Tigers. At the time, couldn't really get picked for the Wallabies. Obviously, that's been tweaked and tweaked and tweaked. But how do you feel? Joe Schmidt's spoken about wanting to pick on shore. Do you think that's a wise decision? Do you think that restriction is, is there enough incentive to stay, to still wear the Wallabies jersey at the moment? Or do you think that going forward, Australia's actually going to have to pick more and more from overseas, and they should be able to?
Yeah, I think the laws around staying here or whatnot, we need to pick the best Wallabies team, like end of. And as much as we don't want to say that we're, the Socceroos, but I think we need to look at it as the Socceroos, that unfortunately the market is so much bigger overseas, whether it be Japan, whether it be France, whether it be England, and we just need to pick our best team, because Australia will get behind a strong Wallabies team that's performing, that's winning games. Look, I understand the trickle-down economics of it all in terms of, if we don't have a strong local comp, if we're not, blah, blah. We don't at the moment. Let's get real. We don't have a strong Super Rugby team at the moment, and it's, for me, we need to prioritise something, and I think we need the Wallabies to be their best. I just don't see why we would go into a fight with one hand tied behind our back. For me, I think we just need to pick our best team. And I'm sure, look, Joe coming in as a foreign coach, I feel like he needs to say that. I feel like he needs to say, yeah, we're going to pick local. I know Dave Rennie said the same thing. Eddie Jones said the same thing. I feel like it's more PR, just quietly. But yeah, I think we need to pick our strongest team, because look, if we get a reality check, where are we? We haven't won a Super Rugby competition in 10 years. We're 8th or 9th in the world or something like that. Like we're only going to slide down further if we don't kind of get up with it.
When does the penny drop, do you think? Are we at rock bottom at the moment? Is there more? Is there a longer way to go?
It's funny you say that, because I kept thinking that during my career, I was like, oh God, we're at the lowest possible, because I grew up watching Todd Ikefu when the Bledisloe or John Eales kick a goal from 15 in, and I thought, oh, we just lost to Argentina. That's as low as it gets. And the game's moving on, and we aren't. We're still thinking that we are the powerhouse that we once were. And, and who would have thought 10, 15 years ago that we'd be talking about Ireland, or Scotland as this kind of moral true north that we want to aim towards. But that's where the game is, and it's moved on. And we're taking a little while to adjust.
Yeah, I think Rod Kafer a couple of years ago, I spoke to him, and he thought that Australian rugby could, you know, rather than spending $1 million trying their absolute best, hanging on to the top five or 10 tiered players, let them go overseas so that you can invest that $5 to $10 million into 14, 15, 16 year olds to ensure they go on to play rugby and then pick them for the Wallabies. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in the coming years about that.
It's been done before though, Christy. If you look in, I think it was 2018 or 2017, the Russie comes into South Africa.
Yeah.
South Africa were a basket case at the time, but he didn't come up with a new game plan or whatever, but it was structurally. He came in and he said, you know what, we're going to let you play overseas, the best players. They can't compete financially with these clubs in Japan. They can't compete. But once again, as you say, we're going to use that money that we've saved on you to spend locally, to spend on grassroots, to spend on community rugby, to develop those players. So then if they go overseas, but they're always going to want to come back and want to play for Australia or South Africa. You know, and for me, letting guys like, you know, Will Skelton go overseas and earn great coin, that money that we're saving on him being here, let's actually invest that in the community game. And then let's get Will back when we need him, you know, to do his job, which is play for the Wallabies and play well. And I think it was a masterstroke that we haven't spoken enough about. I think that Russie really turned it. He didn't change the game on the field. He really altered with the structure of it. And I think it's a way forward for us.
He does seem like a motivator as well, Russie Erasmus, but I completely acknowledge your point. I think it's a really valid one. Super Rugby, Moana Pacific are taking on the Rebels this week, and a couple of your former teammates in Sakopi Kepu and Christian Leilifano up against the Rebels. I imagine you would have been impressed with the Moana Pacific's late victory over Fiji. They held on. The Drua came back with a wet sail, that's for sure. But what are you excited about this game, and how do you think the Moana Pacifica have progressed year on year under Tanaramanga?
I think the main thing is that they have progressed. I think that might have been the first time they've beaten the Drua. And look, you know, cards on the table. I looked at the games on the weekend and I probably thought, oh, this might be a bit boring, this one. And it was by far the most exciting one. it was high quality rugby. It was entertaining. I just think to see Moana develop and look, they need strong leaders whilst they're establishing that club, and to have a guy like Sikopi, to have Christian, to have, you know, Tana leading the charge there, I think is just invaluable, because it'd be very difficult. A club who's trying to find its identity, you know, they're from Auckland but they represent the Pacific, like it's a bit all over the place. And I think the leadership that they've shown has been awesome. It's been good to see.
Yeah, it was a cracking game, and it was really, on the whole, it was a really successful Super Round. I think it's got to be moved away from Melbourne, regardless of whether or not the Rebels stay in the competition. Where would you like it to be played in 2025, Matt?
Brisbane. I think Ballymore, old school, fill it. I think it would be great. I think the Queenslanders will get around it. Look, I as a young kid, I remember back in the day, we used to go to Ballymore and you'd have the barbecues out on the outside and whatnot. And I think with all the, you know, the new centre that they've got there, I think there'd be enough support there for sure.
Yeah, the great point about that as well, Ballymore owned by the Queensland Reds, it wouldn't be money going to the big stadia of the world. It'd be going back into Australian rugby, and I'm sure splitting it with New Zealand and the rest of the competition. That's a really valid point. There's a couple of ovals next to Ballymore where players can warm up. So that's a cracking idea. I think Sydney's, obviously, I think it's a good option as well. And if you're looking to play it in New Zealand, Wellington would be great. That's a really good wrap of Super Rugby. We're not going to go into sevens too much at all, but Anton DuPont just continues to get the business. I think it was France's first World Series title win in a couple of decades. Like that, they've really turned it around, and heading into Paris, their home Olympics, to have someone like DuPont, to have a winning side, to have a pretty strong women's sevens team, they are shaping up really nicely.
They are, and I think he's surprised about 0.1 people in the world. He is just he's amazing. And look, I saw, you know, and it's probably, I think I saw someone talking about how the French had been building and all that. But look, just having a guy like that lifts people around you, you know, the influence, you know, and it's he's one of seven, not one of 15, you know, so his influence on the team's going to be even greater. And I think it's super exciting. You think of what, you know, gold medalists do in home games. It's great. So, yeah, good to see a guy like that doing well.
It might be a stretch, but if they were to win gold, it'd be amazing to think that he potentially could be in a reckoning for a World Sevens Player of the Year, having won the 15s Player of the Year a couple of years ago. Simon Raoulouis, that's a credit to you. You put that one out there, friend of the pod. If there was one Aussie Wallaby or current Australian rugby player that you could parachute into the Sevens team, or who would you want to see, or hypothetically, who would you love to see in a Sevens jersey?
I think Corey Toole would be pretty good. I think, you know, he's done it before, unfortunately, so I don't think I'm saying anything too outlandish there. But, you know, why not put someone like a Taniela in there? If you had him coming off in the last 2 minutes of the game, I think it would provide something different. I personally have always been a fan of, I know we have rugby sevens where the game's open. I'd love to actually play a rugby eights where it's just scrums in the 22. And I think Taniela would be the only one who'd be picked in both formats.
You just hope that there wasn't any early pushes, I'll tell you that. But that's an interesting idea. Last one. So the Aussie women lost in the final against the Kiwis. They probably got dusted there pretty comfortably. A yellow card to Maddie Levi, but she was outstanding throughout the tournament, as were the entire side. The men won their pool comfortably, actually. They beat New Zealand, US, and then Samoa, but they fell up short against Great Britain in their quarterfinal, ended up finishing the competition by beating the US. No Michael Hooper. It's got to be racing in the clock now for him, but I imagine he'll be given so much time to try to find his way into that team.
Yeah, you'd think so. I was actually lucky enough. I was speaking to Hoops earlier today, and just a couple little niggly leg injuries, and no one's more frustrated than he is. So I'm sure he's keen to get back in there, and he'll provide a lot of experience. And look, after the first day, we were flying, the men and the women, and you know, sevens is such a quick thing; it changes so quickly. So look, this stuff will all add to experience. At the end of the day, whilst, you know, we want to win as many competitions as we can, it's an Olympics year, which I'm sure they've all kind of bookmarked.
Yeah, totally. I'll be going up Super W launch on Wednesday. I think it's at Ballymore. So looking forward to that and talking a little bit of more women's rugby in the months to come. It's a bumper campaign for the Wallaroos. Matt Tamua, your side had a good win on the weekend against Kubota, Bernard Foley's team. So congratulations to you. Thanks everyone for listening, and Lucan, of course, for jumping on today's pod. It was a cracker, and it was really nice to hear him back in Aussie rugby. Awesome to see.
Thanks for having us, Christy. Thanks for everyone listening, and yeah, send some suggestions and what you want to hear in the future. We appreciate it.
Can't wait. We'll do it all again next week. Cheers.